Welcome back to the Roundtable. I was in college when I got my first copy of The Stories of John Cheever. It was published in 1978 and brought together some of the finest short fiction ever written. It was an amazing and is an amazing volume. The collection was honored with the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, and it went on to sell millions of copies and really to define the American short story and shape generations of writers. Well, growing up, Susan Cheever, John Cheever's eldest child and only daughter, read what he read, heard what he heard, bantered and gossiped with him and her brothers and mother at the dinner table, and later watched her father type on the cheap yellow paper that he favored. In the book When All Men Wore Hats, Susan Cheever looks back on her father's work and seeks to understand the connections between art and life. And it is a great pleasure to welcome Susan Cheever to the Roundtable this morning for an extended conversation about John Cheever, her work, his work, and the new book, When All the Men Wore Hats. It's a delight to have you here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's always wonderful to talk to someone like you. And also, I just love seeing my audience or hearing my audience. It's one of the great pleasures of the way we live now as writers that you can actually email people or get emails from people and, you know, see the actual people. Does that even make sense?
It does. It absolutely does. Good. Because otherwise it can be very solitary and very lonely, I would imagine.
Yeah, and it's strange, you know, writing to people you never see. So one of the beauties of a book tour is you actually get to see your audience.
The book, When All the Men Wore Hats, is an account of the stories of John Cheever. That was published in 1978. And what was it that you wanted to accomplish with this volume and to take it just a little bit further of ultimately how long has, in your mind, this been in the works?
Well, the book, I had decided that I didn't want to write any more books because it's hard, it's painful, and this book just sort of came and got me, and I think it began, 2017, 2016, a bunch of my friends asked me to lunch or asked me to coffee, and each one of them wanted to talk about my father's short stories because my friends were teaching the short stories at places like Princeton and Yale. And I thought, and as it turned out, when they started asking me questions about the short stories, I knew a lot. Of course I did. And so I began to think that I should be teaching the short stories. But I wasn't sure how to make that happen, although I love teaching. But I ended up giving a lecture about the short stories. And that started the process of writing the book. What I wanted to do, I love the idea of a book about a book, or criticism as narrative is a fancier way to say it. And so I wanted to write a book about my father's red book of short stories. And, you know, the great surprise of writing it, and it took a long time, obviously, was that the short stories are magnificent. And, you know, I knew they were pretty good. I knew what prizes he had gotten. I knew this, I knew that. But I hadn't quite realized how good they are. And so it was a joy to wade back into the short stories, read them again, read the journal entries that went with the short stories, read the letters, and think about also where the short stories came from, because my father and I were sort of reading buddies. And we were certainly gossip buddies, and to also think about what the country was, what was happening politically at the time the stories were written. There was a lot to say about these stories, but the thing that surprised me and delighted me, of course, was that the stories are great.
You make a note to the reader very early at the beginning of the book about how in 1984, your book, Home Before Dark, was a book very much about your father's life, saying that this is a book about his work. And you say the connection between the life and the work is my real subject, and the two sometimes overlap. Give us a sense of what it was like to make that connection, really, to take a look at the work and to focus on that.
Well, it was fascinating. And, you know, what I started out, the question I started with was this. So we'd be sitting at the dining room table gossiping about some neighbors who, you know, had just been arrested or whatever they had done. And I would have just read at my father's instruction some book that he was excited about, you know, a new translation of Madame Bovary, whatever, James Bond, right? And he would get up and he would have in his head all the same things that I had in my head. And he would walk across the living room, past the Victrola and the piano, and sit down in the little room where he worked. And he would take all these facts and pieces of gossip and pieces of literature and weave them into an incredible short story. And I wanted to know what made that happen. What made those bits and bobs in his head suddenly come together in these extraordinary ways? And so I was actually unable to answer that question. I think it's some kind of magic that happens for certain writers, but I did ask the question. So that was my real question. How did he turn straw into gold? What made that happen?
Given that you were, as you were growing up, and you were the eldest child, you were there for so much of the writing and I assume spending, as you outline, so much of your time just watching the work being created. At what point, even in your life, did you realize that work what ultimately was his profession, and what was so important to not only him, but to the outside world?
Well, I think as a child, you don't have those kinds of realizations. I just thought, you know, I wasn't a very critical child. I just thought, well, my father's a writer, and that's what he does. And I knew that other fathers wore hats and went down to the railroad station and commuted to, quote unquote, real jobs. I didn't think much about it in terms of the difference between being a writer and being everybody else. And my father was also, you know, my father, the police would occasionally arrest him in the afternoon because he would be, you know, in old clothes wandering down the street to get the mail. And men weren't supposed to be loitering in the afternoons in the suburbs. So I was aware that he was different from other fathers, and also I was a little embarrassed because my father, although his stories are as clean as stories can be, they were thought to be a little bit, what is the word, sexy in those days. And I remember going on a play date and having my friend's father say to me, well, you know, I know your father's a writer and we don't read those kinds of books in our house. So I was a little embarrassed about that. It was a hodgepodge of things. But I think mostly I just accepted what happened, as children do.
Just take a story like The Country Husband. When you encountered that in for this project, what is it that you're looking to do and to find out, to let us in on?
Well, The Country Husband is such an interesting story because it's one of the very few stories that has actually three plots going on.
Mm-hmm.
In general, Achiever's story has one plot, but The Country Husband, he just went wild. And, you know, and I think to great effect, one of the things about The Country Husband, and this is one of my favorite stories, is that when I was about 12, you know, my mother took me to the orthodontist, as mothers do take children. And the orthodontist said, oh, you know, her overbite is completely wrong. She needs braces. And so my mother, you know, we we came home and my mother said to my father, uh-oh, you know, Susie, that was me, needs braces. And my father just went nuts on me. He was like, how could you, you know, your braces are going to bankrupt me. You've ruined the family's finances. I have to now, because of your braces, I have to write another story for The New Yorker. I don't have another story to write. You know, if only you hadn't sucked your thumb, this wouldn't have happened. He was a little drunk, to be fair, but he really let me have it for needing braces. And then, you know, under all this duress with all this yelling and screaming, he sat down and wrote The Country Husband. And what I say in the book over and over again is he didn't want me to be a writer. He didn't teach me how to write, but I watched him. And what I learned from that right then was that it doesn't matter why you write a story. You don't have to be pure of heart to write a beautiful story. You can write a story to pay for your daughter's braces, and it can be one of the best short stories ever written. So, you know, there was a lot going on in that household, but that's my first, one of the interesting things I think about The Country Husband is that it's a rich, fabulous story. And it, you know, was written to pay for my braces.
I can't help but to go back to what we were talking about before, that because of that, it seems almost impossible to decouple the work for the work versus what you remember and what was going on in the house in many cases. I mean, that must have been difficult.
Well, I don't know. At the time, of course, all of this was very under wraps. At the time when this was happening in the 60s and 70s and 80s, nobody talked about the circumstances of great writing. And my father was really stonewalled this. He would say, you know, if I said to him, hey, did you notice that in Saul Bellow's last book, he made fun of Richard Eberhardt, right? My father would say, you're reducing literature to gossip. He was absolutely against anybody discussing in any way the relationship of real life to his work. And he protected that as well as he could. And he would say, you know, fiction is not crypto autobiography. So he was always very opposed to the idea that there was any, you know, any connection between our lives and the work. And sometimes I would challenge him. I mean, I would say to him, you know, how could you do this or that? Because, you know, you didn't want to start a fight with my father because he would win the fight in the pages of the New Yorker, which is not a good place to lose a fight. So, but, you know, I would say to him, how could you put me in this story? And he would say, well, that's not you. That's the little girl who's, you know, comes from my teeming imagination. And I would say, but she's wearing my clothes. So we did some fighting about this, but he was very, very adamant that it was wrong to in any way connect art of any kind, but certainly his short stories to life. He was very, very fierce about that, partly to protect himself, I think. But partly because I think he really believed that art would not survive a mixing up of the art with the artist.
When you were going through, I'm curious as to get what you wanted to write what you wanted to write about the stories. How many times did you have to read? I realize this would vary, but how many times did you have to read them? How often would you pore over a sentence, or was it better to just go from almost recollection?
Well, that's a really good question. The first thing I did when I realized that I was going to write the book, so the first thing I did was pull out. You know, my father kept journals, and Knopf published one volume of journals, but there actually are about 10 or 20 volumes. So I pulled out the boxes out of my closet that have the manuscript of his journals in it. because I knew that I wanted to read the journals along with the stories and see what he had said about the life when he was writing the stories. And then the second thing I did was I sat down and read the stories, beginning to end, all 61 of them in the Red Book. And that kind of made it clear which stories I cared about, which stories I wanted to write about, and which stories, you know, I made a rule for myself. I tried to have 4 or 5 information streams going on at the same time. So I would have the story, a letter he had written about the story, a journal entry about the story, my own memory of what happened that caused the story to be written. So I don't even know. I seem to have skirted your question, and I'm not really answering it. I just started with the stories, and as I said, I was surprised by how good they are. I mean, they are good. And also surprised by how many of them could have been written yesterday. Mm. So, I mean, the 548, it could have been written yesterday. And so, and it's a magnificent story. So that the big surprise for me was that, A, I couldn't figure out how he pulled everything together into a story. And B, the stories are unbelievably good, sentence for sentence, as you say.
There are so many stories, and you read about this, but there's so many stories that things go start one way and end up the other. So they yeah. start poorly and they end up okay, or they start okay and good and they end up bad. Your father liked that. Either way, he liked those surprises.
He liked surprises. He liked reversals. And he loved the work of H.H. Monroe and O. Henry. In other words, writers who really deal in stories that are only surprises. He liked surprises. You're right about that. But what good writer doesn't like surprises? Anyway, sorry. See, I've been teaching writing for 30 years now. And so that also came into play. So I have a different way of looking at writing than I did when the stories were being written. And that was interesting. That, again, I hate to keep saying this, but as a writing teacher, I was just stunned by how talented he was. That sounds really dumb, but I was.
Susan Cheever is our guest. We are talking about her new book, When All Men Wore Hats. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. The new book by Susan Cheever is When All the Men Wore Hats. It looks at the stories of John Cheever and puts them into a context with Susan Cheever's own life.
I guess going back to the reversal, and in the stories that were very similar to things that happened to you and happened in the house and happened in the family, did those reversals also take place, or were they some way a fictionalization or the fictionalization of what was happening?
Well, another good question. I think that he loved reversals, and he especially seemed to love reversals in which very happy people, like the people in the Enormous Radio, who their big flaw is that they love classical music, right? This sounds good, right? It's not going to be good. So he loved to take something that looked very beautiful on the outside or very peaceful on the outside and show you how right underneath the surface there was something much less peaceful and happy. And I think that's what he loved to do. And certainly in our lives as a family, we had our ups and downs. But I think that essentially, to answer your question, he had both the setup of, he had both inside him at all times. In other words, he was both that happy man who had, you know, created this beautiful family, and he was that miserable man who didn't know how he was going to go on for another day or two. And I think part of what contributed to that is that he was bisexual, he was gay. And so he had to create, in order to preserve himself and us, a completely fictitious world not in fiction, but in real life. So he created this completely fictitious world in which he was a heterosexual aristocrat with three tow-headed children and Labrador dogs and et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, that was not what was happening in his head at all. So he was creating a fiction on top of a fiction on top of a fiction. And I think that made it a little more confusing. Although I have to say, another thing that happened to me when I was writing this book is I got so sad about what he had to go through. I mean, what a gay man had to go through in the 1950s in this country. We've forgotten. We've forgotten how bad it was. And he lived in fear. He lived in fear that somebody was going to blow the whistle and he would be taken to jail like his friend Newton Harmon. I mean, people were jailed for life for being gay. I mean, as I say, I feel as if we've forgotten about it. But I just got so sad. I'm still so sad that he had to do that, that he had to live that way, that he had to make his, you know, make his truest self a secret self. I think it may have helped the writing, because the writing is so fizzy. But I certainly don't think, I'm just sad that he had to go through that and horrified that I didn't even notice.
Do you think your mother noticed? I mean, you say that your mother was your father's most important audience.
Yes, I think she knew.
Hmm.
But I think she, I'm looking for a word. You can help me. For that state you're in where you know and don't know at the same time.
Right.
We've all had it. And I think that's where she was. She knew and didn't know at the same time.
What was it like? And it just strikes me because you talk about how hard and how difficult it must have been. And the thing that came to my mind as you were saying that with emotion in your voice is when it becomes an episode on a sitcom.
Well, it's 40 years later, so we can laugh at things 40 years later that it would have been harder to laugh at the time they happened. But that Seinfeld episode is certainly the perfect proof of what I'm saying. We've come so far in this country when it comes to sexual fluidity that now there's a Seinfeld episode about my father being gay. At the time when he was gay, right?
Right.
1950, 1960, that could never have happened.
Did you find it funny at the time?
Well, at first I thought maybe I had hurt Larry David's feelings somehow, because the woman is also named Susan, and they have a cabin, and we have a cabin, and it burned down, and ours burned down. You know, there are quite a few kind of weird parallels, but I asked somebody to ask him, and he said, no, it wasn't that I had hurt his feelings somehow. He just thought it was funny, and it is funny, but it wouldn't have been funny in 1960, I can tell you.
And that's the case for many of these stories of the things of looking back at what the mood of the room was at the time that they were being written, at the time that they were being, that they were happening, especially when there was a fictional world that was being created.
Right. Well, time is an amazing thing. I guess that's not that as wise as I meant it to sound, but things have changed. And as I say, take a story like the 548, it could have been written yesterday, but other things have really, really changed. Actually, I think now that I think about it, maybe I can whip up an argument for the immortality of literature. The stories actually are as good as they ever were. The life, the circumstances of the life of our lives as a family have really changed.
So this fascinates me. So knowing more, reading your book, does that, could that, were you worried that that would change how we read the story now?
How do you mean?
Meaning that if I have the knowledge, if I have the knowledge that you're writing in this book about the situation of even from the last book of what was going on, that's a different experience. Perhaps I have knowledge that I did not have if I was reading that
at the time. Got it. No, yeah. Well, that's a fascinating question. I mean, my favorite iteration of that question is, what if Picasso had not called that painting Guernica, so that you had no idea that it was about the Spanish Civil War when you see that painting?
Right.
Would it be a better painting or not as good a painting? And I don't have the answer to that. I mean, I do know that my father hated the idea of looking at stories or art through the lens of life or reality or whatever we're going to call it. But I think the stories hold up even if you know where they come from. In fact, in a way, they hold up more, I think, if you know where they come from. And that's, you know, my father's been dead for 44 years, 42 years, a long time. So I certainly didn't feel that I had to do what he would have wanted me to do. But I also, we live in a world now where everything is in the light. I mean, there's no more possibility of somebody, you know, writing secretly or writing about something that nobody else knows what it is. Everybody knows everything now. And so I wanted to look at the stories from that point of view. And I was thrilled that they're still great. And for instance, you know, one of the great stories is Goodbye, My Brother. And the story of Goodbye, My Brother is that my father wrote it, and it's about essentially two brothers at their summer place. And I wanted to, you know, investigate the story, but it turns out that originally the two brothers were one character, and that one character had these two sides to him, to echo something I said earlier in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
One was the bean counter side, the Lawrence side in Goodbye, My Brother, and the other was the kind of fuzzy wuzzy prep school teacher side in Goodbye, My Brother. And it was actually Malcolm Cowley who suggested to my father that he split the character into two. And that's what he did. And that's what makes the story so great. But I think knowing that, for me at least, knowing that makes the story better, because you can see how he did what he did, or you can feel more how he did what he did. But I'm not sure he would like that. I'm not sure he would. You know, my father destroyed all his correspondence. He wasn't interested in telling people his secrets.
I was thinking about this as I was reading. There's a new collection of stories by Harper Lee. And what we know generally is that she didn't want those published. And to me, it's a different experience in reading it, because it almost seems wrong. And while for literature and the history of literature, it's fascinating, but it does change the way you read it.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also a big question. And I would say, if you don't want something published, burn it. Well, I mean, you know, we live in a different world than Harper Lee, where she thought she could keep somebody from publishing something. That's not the world we live in. And, you know, the world we live in is the world we have. And the world we have right now, if you don't want something published, there's one way to affect that. But I don't know. No, I certainly think my father fought and fought and fought and fought with me conversationally about whether or not it was okay to talk about the real life incidents that had inspired, he would hate all these words, his stories. And I often got scolded for it. And there's a, just to tell another story, there's a story called The Hartleys that he wrote, in which a family goes skiing. And my parents told me not to read the story, so I immediately read it, of course. And a family goes skiing, and I recognized the family, and I recognized the little girl in the family. And I recognized the house where they stayed, and I recognized the ski slope, which happened to be Suicide 6 in Woodstock, Vermont. And at the end of the story, the little girl gets crushed to death, killed in the rope tow. And so I'm reading it. I'm 12 years old. I'm like, ugh. And later in my life, when I was a little boy, I said, how could you do that, right? How could you write a story in which the little girl, me, gets crushed to death in a ski tow? And so, and also, he also killed off my brothers and my mother, so I wasn't alone. He said that it was a product of his tremendous anxiety about me getting hurt on the ski slope, right? That it was the way he expressed his anxiety. And I just, that didn't sound right to me at all, right? So yeah. What I did was, in my first novel, I wrote the same scene, only instead of having the little girl get crushed to death, I had the father rescue the little girl, right? So the little girl gets dragged up the hill, but then the father rescues her. And she knows he's going to rescue her. Well, my father loved that, right? So there was we were often in conversation about this taboo topic of what is the relationship of art to life. But it's fascinating to me, and it's fascinating to me to be and to talk to other people who get written about, because it's very weird when you go to a party and someone comes up to you and says, well, you know, I thought the third boyfriend you had when you were in college was the best one. And you think, what are they talking about? And you realize they've read some story of your father's and, you know, extrapolated what they wanted to extrapolate. But I think that the relationship between art and life is extremely complicated and delicate and mysterious. And so in this book, I wanted to illustrate what I could of it, and then leave the rest up to the reader.
I'm fascinated by the going back to the tow rope of him giving the answer that it had to do with his anxiety and a concern about you and the anxiety of what could happen. And I don't know. I think, like, if my mom wrote that, I would think, oh, well, that tracks. So there was something about the anxiety part that didn't track for you.
Right. I didn't believe that his anxiety about me had caused him to write the scene where I was crushed to death in a ski tow. It didn't track for me. And I didn't think he was particularly anxious about me at Suicide 6, by the way.
And then you talk about the conversation that you have back and forth, and but that's through art. If I'm hearing you correctly in the telling of that story just a moment ago, the more honest conversation is taking place in your novel in answer to his story than it would be if you sat down to discuss it.
Well, yes and no. I'm not sure it's the more honest conversation. Not to get too highfalutin, but for me, in order to write about that character in my first novel, I had to forgive him. I had to forgive my father. And I do think that forgiveness is the prerequisite for all good writing. You just have to let go of what is really there, the unforgivable nature of other people, and you just have to let go of it and look to the writing instead of your feelings. And so I was able to forgive, not only forgive the fact that he killed me in the ski tow, which of course he didn't, it's fiction, by writing a scene in which he's the hero rather than the villain. It's been suggested to me actually recently that I should have written a scene in which the father gets killed in the ski tow. Mm. But that would have been fun, but it wouldn't have furthered the cause of writing a good novel, which is what I had in mind. Once you're writing fiction or nonfiction, I don't think it's that different. You're in another country. And the place where this really comes home is, so I didn't like being written about by my father, and I swore that no matter what happened, I would not write about my own children if I ever had children. So guess what? For 10 years, I wrote a parenting column for Newsday about my children. And they got written about over every week. And I made it okay with myself by saying to them, asking their permission, and then asking their permission to publish each column. And of course, they didn't know what they were agreeing to. I mean, at the beginning, they were quite young, but in the end, at the end, they would start saying, no, you can't publish that. No, you can't publish that. And I started paying them. So, you know, what could be tackier than me paying my children to allow to allow me to write about their most embarrassing moments in Newsday?
It certainly doesn't come through in reading the book, but in what we've described of writing about the stories and what you're telling us, it seems as though it could have been, and I'm asking if it was, just emotionally exhausting.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it was sort of, I had sort of a wonderful time writing this book, and I don't even know why, so don't ask me, because I don't know. But somehow, you know, one of the great things about being a nonfiction writer is that I feel I get to bring people back to life.
Mm-hmm.
I get to take the pictures off the wall and make them dance. I get to, you know, whether it's Nathaniel Hawthorne or my father, it's just a fantastic privilege to be able to bring someone to life on the page. And I mean, of course, it doesn't always work. But I've felt very close to him as I was reading his journals and writing about the stories. And that felt very good. And also, of course, he certainly would disapprove of many of the things that I do and am doing, but he certainly would approve of me getting a bigger audience for the stories. So in a way, I was even doing him a favor in spite of himself. You know, I miss the writing of the book. I miss my immersion in the short stories. So I don't think it was exhausting. I think it was more like exhilarating, although truth to tell, exhausting and exhilarating are not that far apart.
That is very, very true. Yes. Were there times in looking at it that you think that, I mean, I assume there's new discoveries along the way, right? I mean, even though you've known the story, you've written about it, you've mined this, you've stepped away from it, and then you come back, that there are new discoveries.
Yes, many new discoveries. Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book is that the stories have had a huge cultural impact. I mean, Mad Men, the first four seasons of Mad Men are based on the stories, the Seinfeld episode. There are a couple of rock and roll songs. You know, Raymond Carver wrote a sequel to one of the stories. I mean, they've had a huge cult. There's a new television show with John Hamm that's based on the Housebreaker. They've had a huge cultural impact, and I wanted to kind of track that and acknowledge that. So that's one of the things that started me off. But, yeah, that's one of the things that started me off. But I don't know. Once I started, it was really unusually, for me, because I find writing very hard, it was unusually pleasurable for me. You know, the book seemed to have a life of its own, as books do.
I think, I don't quite know how to ask this, but it does seem that in reading the stories that your father wrote, and I'm not saying there are wonderful writers writing wonderful stories, but it is different, isn't it?
How do you mean?
Meaning that it just doesn't seem to have that gravitas that it did when your father did it.
It doesn't?
I don't know.
Well, those were the days, you know, when he did it. I mean, they were terrible days, as witness that we lived a completely secret life. But they were also simpler days. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe that's not fair to say. But
I guess what I'm saying is that it would be hard. Like, you know, who's the next John Cheever? Not that we're looking for one, but to come up with that list, it's to me would be difficult to have someone who has reached, no matter what the backstory is, has reached that plateau.
Well, I think we've changed our standards completely since then, so it wouldn't be a white male, for one thing.
Yep.
And it wouldn't be a gay white male, bisexual. I call him gay, even though he was bisexual, for another thing. And it also, I mean, my father's relationship with the New Yorker, which I did go into quite a lot, but nobody has that kind of relationship with magazines anymore, for better or for worse. You know, that the stories themselves, like you can read the 548 right now this afternoon and think that could be happening right now this afternoon, seems sort of miraculous to me.
Yes.
Because a lot of things have changed. I don't want to say everything, but many things.
Do you feel when you completed this that you, like right now, do you feel that you still have more that you would like to explore when it comes to your family and it comes to your father, or have you exhausted that within yourself?
Another good question. I think at one level, at most levels, I've exhausted it. You know, but as I was saying before, the actual journals that my father kept, which are extraordinary, have never been published. So I would very much like to find a way to get the full journals published. For instance, there's a box of his stories in my living room that were published, but in places like Story Magazine, or that were published in the 30s and 40s that most people have never seen, uncollected stories. I'd like to see those get published. So I'm not quite done with the business part of it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm done with reading and rereading the stories themselves. But who knows? You know, we never know what's going to happen in this life, Joe.
No.
I mean, is one ever free of one's parents? Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
And do we want to be?
Well, good question.
And which also just popped into my brain, but how are there stories by your father that have not been, or that have not been put together, or are you even wanting the journals to be published? It seems like that would be something that people would want.
It seems to me too, and I want it. So that's good enough for me.
There you go.
No, I mean, when, you know, I want the uncollected stories published and I want the journals published, and I think he would want that too. But I haven't had the time or the energy or the power to make those things happen. But I haven't given up.
The name of the new book is When All the Men Wore Hats, on the stories of John Cheever by Susan Cheever. Susan, it's an absolute delight to speak with you, and such a pleasure and privilege. And I thank you so much for sharing the time and the real in-depth nature with us this morning.
Thank you. It was a complete pleasure, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Again, the name of the book is When All Men Wore Hats by Susan Cheever. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.